Hey, everybody. Welcome into the back room. I'm Andy Ostroy. We have a fun conversation for you today with writer Stephanie Mensimer. We'll get to Stephanie in a second, but first, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you listening, and we'd love to hear your comments. So email us at backroomandy@gmail.com and or a post on our social media, and we'll read some feedback next time. And if you like the podcast, please rate and review and follow or subscribe, and you'll be notified every time we post a new episode. So, Stephanie Mensimer. She covers legal affairs and domestic policy in Mother Jones's Washington Bureau. She is the author of Blocking the Courthouse Door, How the Republican Party and Its Corporate Allies Are Taking Away Your Right to Sue. She appeared in the documentary Hot Coffee, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2011, and was based in part on her book. She is also a contributing editor of the Washington Monthly, a former investigative reporter at the Washington Post, and senior writer at the Washington City Paper. She was nominated for a National Magazine Award in 2004 for a Washington Monthly article about myths surrounding the medical malpractice system. Her latest piece in Mother Jones is called From Laddie Mag Model to RNC Co-Chair, Lara Trump, Nepo Spouse. Stephanie, welcome into the back room.
Thanks for having me.
You recently wrote a piece for Mother Jones called From Laddie Mag Model to RNC Co-Chair, Lara Trump, Nepo Spouse. The whole Lara Trump thing is quite fascinating, isn't it?
Yes. She's, I think, one of the underappreciated members of the Trump clan. You know, she hasn't been in the news until just recently. Like, she didn't have the same kind of high profile as Ivanka and Jared and Don Jr.
And you'd say that in the sense of she's underappreciated in the outside world or underappreciated within the Trump family?
Might have been both. I think there was a time where Trump himself said he wouldn't recognize her if he ran into her on the street.
He probably didn't like her.
Well, actually, I think what happened, it's kind of a famous story about her where because she dated Eric for like 6 years before they got married. So she was hanging around for a long time before anything was official. And I think Trump basically ignored her most of that time. But I guess it was in 2016, he was watching Fox News and there was this woman on there who was just doing this fabulous job of defending him. And then he realized it was Lara. And he was like, oh, you know, she's great on television. And, you know, he loves people who look good on TV. And after that, they've become very tight and she became a bigger part of the campaign. So.
And is that just because he's so transactional and all about loyalty? I mean, the anecdote you're explaining is all about what she did for him to protect him, defend him. And that's all it's ever about with him. But then at the end of the day, no matter who it is, with perhaps the exception of Ivanka, don't they all end up getting thrown under the bus, whether it's family or cabinet members or aides? It just is once that transactional relationship runs its course. Like, I envision a day when he is just brutal to Lara Trump, like, especially if he loses and it's because the RNC didn't raise enough money. Like, you can almost hear the complaining.
Maybe so. I mean, it's hard to say. I think that the only people who actually do stick with Trump are his family. Like, that's all that's left for him. You know, everybody else tends to go to jail or, you know, turn on him, or they just sort of steer clear. So it's hard to say with her. I saw actually this morning that the RNC today sent out a robocall, but it was a scripted call to voters. And it was, you know, to Republican voters saying that the Democrats had stolen the 2020 election. And it was a message from Lara Trump. And she's gone like all in about the voter fraud. And I think that's why Trump wanted her at the RNC. That's why he decided that Ronna McDaniel needed to go, because she was too wobbly on the, you know, the big lie about the election. She wouldn't just come out and say Trump won. But Lara says Trump won. Mm-hmm. Like, she's very committed to the idea that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. So he loves her for that. And I guess she's carrying that message now through the RNC, even though, you know, they're having this mixed problem. They're trying to get people to vote early and by mail. But Trump's out there saying it's all fraudulent. So she's got quite a job ahead of her.
I mean, he's such a candidate. And I hate to even use that word because I loathe anything that tends to normalize him. But he's such a candidate the campaign is such a campaign and the party is such a party of conflict and contradiction that every time it or they or he opens the mouth, like, just, it's, what are you saying? What is the point to any of this? It's like the wind, just everything changes like the wind.
Yes. You saw a lot of that yesterday with the mm-hmm. Arizona abortion decision.
Yeah, he's flailing. He's flailing on
oh,
that.
He's all over the map. He's first like, well, we should leave this to the states. Oh, oops. Well, when we do that, they want to go back to the 1800s. So maybe we don't want to do that, but we should put the doctors in jail if they try to give, you know, do abortions. I mean, they have no message at this point on that.
So you start your piece with a quote from Laura. And it is, quote, "With Eric by my side, I've done things I've never imagined possible. Believe me, 10 years ago, if you'd asked me if I'd be part of a presidential campaign, I would have said, you're crazy." She's right, of course, right? Like, but this craziness, this nepotism, which includes her husband, Eric, his brother, his sister, that's just part of their normal craziness. It's all crazy.
Yes. Yes. And I think what I found interesting about Laura is that she, I wouldn't say she comes from a humble background. Her father built yachts, you know, for like Walter Cronkite. And he was, he's a yacht builder in North Carolina, had a business that did this. They live in a house that's worth now like $3 million. So she didn't come from, you know, some poor backwater. Mm-hmm. She went to North Carolina State, to state school. And she, you know, she started her journalism career, I guess, in college. She did study communications and did a couple of internships. But really, like, her career is utterly unremarkable until after she gets involved with the Trumps. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't really do anything of, you know, she works at Hooters. She, you know, does swimsuit calendars. She, you know, attempts, I think, to become a model and maybe an actor, which didn't, I don't think, work out very well. And then all of a sudden, you know, she meets Eric Trump, and she doesn't seem to be really gainfully employed again for several years. And in 2014 or 2012, I think it was, she suddenly gets this job at Inside Edition, like out of the blue. And I don't work in broadcast, but I know that, like, those jobs are kind of hard to come by. Mm-hmm. Like, broadcast journalism is super competitive. And she had no experience. Like, she, before that, had been baking cakes and selling them out of her apartment. And all of a sudden, she's, like, on television. She's got this really high-profile job in New York. And so I started looking at that, and I was like, how did that happen? You know, clearly, she knew somebody. And then it turns out that Inside Edition was one of Donald Trump's favorite shows. Mm-hmm. Like, he was such a regular guest on there that they had him write the foreword to a book on the history of Inside Edition. And he said that he had been on the show more than 300 times. And they loved him there. He was on there all the time. So, you know, what are the odds that it was just a coincidence that Laura Trump got this job that her father-in-law was on all the time? I don't think so. I couldn't get anybody to actually come out and say that. I tried to confirm that he had something to do with it. But, you know, it just looks kind of strange. And so those are, like, that was her big professional leap, was onto that show. And then she had to quit when Trump really got close to the election. She was working on the campaign in 2016. And so she hasn't done much TV other than campaign related since then. But mm-hmm. it's an interesting career trajectory for somebody who, you know, and, like, I think looking at her background was kind of unspectacular, you know, personal trainer, maybe she liked to ride horses. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden she's the head of the RNC.
Yeah, well, she's a leech. She's a Nepo baby. She knows where her bread is buttered, just like her husband and his brother and his sister. None of them have anything in their lives without their father. And I think they're all terrified right now because the spigot is about to be turned off. If it hasn't already, he's likely going to be a convicted felon, and that dries up anything brand related and all that. And she's part of that. And you see that now. She's all in. And so, you know, you mentioned Hooters. She was a bikini model in Maxim Magazine's Hometown Hotties contest. And she was a nearly naked model in the now defunct magazine Stuff. All of which, of course, in my opinion, not only makes her perfectly qualified for GOP leadership, but also First Lady. I mean, she's not that different than Melania, right? Like, they kind of have very similar career paths, right? And this is where we are today.
Yeah. And I just want to say that I think Hooters girls should be able to do whatever they want.
Sure.
You know, you could run for president of having been a Hooters girl. Like, you make good tips there, I guess, and, you know, put up with a lot of creepy men. But, you know, it's not like that in itself should be disqualifying, but it does tell you something a little bit about her character and you know, interests. When I first started looking at her background, I thought, well, maybe she just really needed the money, you know, but I don't think she did. I think her family was pretty well off and she just liked it. And that, you know, that's a different kind of person. And that's sort of like influencer culture. She fits right in with that. I think she was a little ahead of her time. You know, if she'd had TikTok back then, she probably would have been, you know, we would have seen her on TikTok showing her bikini buff body, you know. She does that on
Instagram now.
Like, yeah, she does.
Yeah. You know, you're raising a really good point from a feministic standpoint. Absolutely. A woman should be able to do whatever job she wants and not be judged. The problem I have with it all is that it's so connected to all the hypocrisy, not just of the Trumps, but of the Republican Party and the right-wing religious extremists and evangelicals. Like, you think about when Michelle Obama bared her arms, you know, what an outcry that was. And here we have, like, a former first lady who was basically doing soft porn photography shoots, and Lara Trump is heading the RNC, and she's got her background. And it's this holier-than-now attitude that I have the problem with. And, you know, in writing about her racy past, you point out the following. You say, quote, "She has used her bully pulpit to impugn the credentials and successes of others not lucky enough to marry the son of a billionaire." And that's really the crux of the criticism, isn't it?
It is. And that's why I thought it was fair to write about her bikini calendars and stuff, because she does it all the time. I was at CPAC, and she was a speaker this year, and she got up there and was talking about how she always tells her, I guess she didn't mention her daughter's only like 4 or 5, but she's like, I drill into her that in America, the only way we get ahead here is through merit and merit alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how she did it with a straight face. You know, like, yeah, you got the RNC job from merit because you spent 30 years in the trenches of the Republican Party of North Carolina or whatever. I mean, like, she didn't do anything to get this job, really, like, that didn't involve her family relations. Mm-hmm. And so she just, you know, she keeps saying things like that. And she's called Kamala Harris like an unqualified diversity hire.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can, however you feel about Kamala, one thing she is not is unqualified.
Right.
Like, she is 100% qualified for mm-hmm. this job. And she, you know, she was a senator, she was a prosecutor, she's had a very, very nice, interesting, respectable, professional, and serious career before she became vice president. And I think that to go out and say something like that when you yourself, you know, you would still be a personal trainer if you weren't married to, you know, to Eric Trump. It just is sort of maddening.
Well, it is, and it speaks to the hypocrisy. They just say whatever they want, and it's propaganda. And if you say it enough, and you say it over and over again, then people believe that Kamala Harris is unqualified, but Lara Trump is. So Lara has said, quote, "I'll tell you what, as a woman, do not ever give me a job, a title, a position, an award, anything that I did not earn. You give me that position because I am the best person for that job, period." This is like an astounding lack of self-awareness and hypocrisy, or colossal hubris and delusion, or just all of the above. I'm not even sure where to put my finger on it, but it's just insanity.
Yeah, that was how I felt too. I was like, does she really believe that? Does she not realize?
Like, I mean, what do you think? Again, do you think she believes it, or do you think she knows it's bullshit and it just works? It works for them.
You know, I think she'd have to be smarter than I suspect she is to know that it's all bullshit. I don't know. I also think it's kind of interesting. There, you know, one of the things about the modern Republican Party is how many people who have an acting background who are involved in high places. You know, like Steve Bannon, for instance, came out of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I think Laura must have done some acting, or she aspired to be an actor. And I think that what she's really good at is learning the lines.
Right.
And I think she's memorized all mm-hmm. the lines. And I don't think she thinks much beyond that. And she's really good at spouting them out and talking about election fraud, or, you know, talking about how affirmative action. She was cheering the Supreme Court decision last year that got rid of basically the use of race in the college admissions. And that was when she was talking about that, and that quote came from. And she was just... seemed so oblivious to her own privilege and how she got to where she was, and so unsympathetic to the idea that other people aren't as lucky. But I think it was just a talking point. Mm-hmm. Like, she's just, you know, somebody gave her the script and she just kind of reads off of it. And I think that is where she fits in. And because she doesn't seem to have any core beliefs herself. I mean, mm-hmm. she wasn't political before any of this. Like, she wasn't involved in politics until Trump ran. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if she was registered to vote. You know, she just really wasn't in politics. So, mm-hmm.
you know, it's interesting because, you know, the argument can be made that she's just like most privileged, entitled people. You know, that expression, born on third base and think you hit a triple. Like, that comes from this place. Like, that's who she is, you know, and maybe not born on third base with her yacht building father, but she was sort of born on third base when she zeroed in on Eric and targeted him and became part of the Trump family. And to your point in the piece that, you know, that bully pulpit as someone who's, you know, hooked a billionaire, the son of a billionaire, that is a place of privilege and entitlement. You know, there's a few references in your piece to comments about women and minorities. Do you think she's a sexist and a racist?
You know, I don't think so. At least not consciously. That's a hard question. I don't know. But I mean, she's clearly opposed to, well, I don't know. The things she said about Kamala Harris, you do have to mm-hmm. wonder.
You know, when analysts on TV, they say, well, I don't know if she's a racist or he's a racist. But he definitely says and does racist things. Okay. I'm not Einstein, yeah. But like A plus B equals C. You know, that just sounds like a cop out. And so she does seem to say sexist and racist things. And one could draw the conclusion that that's who she is.
Yeah. It's part of the script, you know. But she also, it's funny, I think it was in the run-up to the 2020 election, she was assigned a task by the Trump campaign to do outreach to minority and LGBT groups who felt like his administration was not good to them. Mm-hmm. And so she was the one meeting with all of these people, and they weren't really like, it's not like she was meeting with the NAACP. She was talking to like, I don't know if they have, I think they had a group, but something like Blacks for Trump or whatever, you know, it's one of those, like those groups, like not, they were like, or like Black conservatives or mm-hmm. Gays for Trump. She met with those guys and she was trying to, you know, woo them and convince them that the Trump, you know, another Trump administration was not going to be discriminatory against them. And so she spent a lot of time with, you know, minority groups working on the campaign. And so I have to think that like some of her rhetoric must tone it down a little, at least to try to do the outreach. But it was interesting that she was the one that, she still has a lot of ties to those real, like the really grifty grassroots Trump fans, and they're who have these kind of low level operations, and she shows up at their events and stuff still, even though there's like 40 people there.
Mm-hmm. So Sean Spicer of Dancing with the Stars fame predicts that with her ability to raise money and demand attention, she will be, quote, the most effective co-chair in modern RNC history. Do you agree?
I think that has a point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because apparently she's very sought after as a speaker. And that's the RNC, you know, when you get down to the bread and butter work of a national campaign, a lot of what they do is support state parties. And every state party wants somebody with a big name to come and show up and talk at their events so that people will come and they'll donate money and get involved and whatnot. And so I think maybe in that sense, she might be. But I think what isn't totally clear is how much input she's having on the actual running of the RNC. Because the co-chair doesn't generally, like historically, hasn't had a lot of, you know, they're not the policy person. They don't point in direction. They're like more of a public face, but there are other people who do the day-to-day kind of operations. I think if you put her in charge of day-to-day operations, it'd probably be a disaster. But if she's just going to be the person who goes on Fox to talk about the campaign, sure, she's probably, you know, going to be good. And as he said, like, can you even name a previous RNC co-chair? I couldn't. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a job that has ever been a very high profile position publicly. I mean, it's kind of a big deal within the party, but the chair really sets the agenda and that sort of thing. But the co-chair does what the chair tells them to do, basically. Right. And sometimes they pick a project, like in the past, Sean told me they, you know, had people who really wanted to focus on voter education or, you know, kind of mundane, you know, bread and butter, again, politicking. And
I'm able to give people their props. To me, Donald Trump is a genius. He's just an evil genius. He knew his audience. He's a terrific marketer and a master at branding to a degree. And he does what he needs to do for himself, according to his plan, really well. And I could see the appeal in Lara Trump. I really do. Like, I see her as the MAGA's dream. Like, you know, the people who go to the rallies, they must love her, just like they love Junior. And so Spicer's right. She could very well be incredibly effective. And she had joined the board of Eric's charitable foundation, but then the foundation ran aground and there was some weird financial fraudulent stuff going on there. Was she involved in any of that, do you think? Was that around her tenure where she had a hand in that?
Well, let's just say that once she joined the board, suddenly a charity that was really designed to raise money for Children's Cancer Hospital suddenly started sending donations to animal rescue groups in North Carolina. And I think that was 100% her, because that's her thing, her side gig. Like, she's very much into animal welfare. She and Matt Gaetz actually have worked on legislation to protect animals from abuse. And she, I think some of the money, if I recall, from the foundation went to like a horse rescue or one of those places where people save horses from the glue factory and stuff like that. And, you know, but donors to the foundation thought they were giving money to kids with cancer and their treatment. Mm-hmm. So that was the fraud, was that it was the money was supposed to be going to one place and it ended up also at Trump golf courses. Mm-hmm.
You sort of close out the piece by citing her popular speech at the recent CPAC conference, where she told the MAGA crowd that she and Eric make their children recite the Pledge of Allegiance before going to bed, that she wants her son to grow up to be a, quote, masculine man, and that she makes her four-year-old daughter understand that, quote, in the United States of America, we get ahead and succeed by merit and merit alone. This is what you mentioned earlier. And then you write, and then, without irony, she thanked her father-in-law for endorsing her as RNC co-chair. How do you square that? Like, either she is a genius and knows that the MAGAs are just stupid, or she is clueless. I can't. This is the thing about them. Like, it's hard to really figure them out. And it's hard to figure her out when she says something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it came off as clueless, I thought. I was just, again, I got, because I was like, how do you say that with a straight face?
Right, from one sentence
I
to
was
the next.
Laughing. Yeah. Like, do not hear yourself.
I mean, it'd be one thing if you say one thing on a Tuesday and the next Saturday you say something which is contrary. But like, from one sentence to the next, like, someone put that together, right?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. And just completely unaware. The crowd goes, woo!
Yeah. Well, because they don't have the ability to hear, you know? So let's shift to Trump and Republican politics overall. You first started covering the party around the birth of the Tea Party, and we thought they were extremist. How do they compare, in your opinion, to today's MAGA crowd?
I mean, they're basically the same people. It's weird. They're always the same age. They're all still like 60-year-old white people, or, you know, like upper middle-aged white people, and who like to wear crazy hats. And I don't think there's a lot of, like, a lot of them are, in fact, there are people I wrote about in 2009 who are involved with the Tea Party who are now very much MAGA people. And so this definitely has been a continuum since then. They just finally got a national leader. I think that before they didn't have somebody like Trump to sort of unify and stamp out the rhinos. You know, they did some of it in the like midterm elections in 2010. You saw like a bunch of people going to Congress who are all Tea Partiers, people like Rick Scott and Mark Meadows. I think that now they're just a lot more cultish. They're more of a cult of personality. Mm-hmm. They used to talk about the budget, you know? Like the Tea Partiers used to pretend like they only cared about like fiscal policy.
Right.
And they try to kind of stay out of like social stuff. But now that's all gone out the window. Like, when was the last time you heard any of these MAGA people talk about the budget or the national debt or like, you know, some of the old Republican platform, you know, smaller government? There's none of that. It's all like, we're going to use the government to crush you and keep you from getting any sort of health care. And, you know, that's, we're going to punish our enemies. And it's all that kind of stuff. And it's all just about Trump. And I think that that's the difference. Like, they've stripped away the pretense of caring about, like, governing in any meaningful way.
Yeah, I think these days when they talk about small government, I think they're literally talking about shooting and killing their opponents so that there's actually less people in Washington, D.C., literal smaller government. But isn't another difference, a key distinction, like the Tea Party, they at least seem to respect and want to protect and defend democracy. They weren't pro-Putin and pro-Russia. You know, the Tea Party, with its connections to, in principle, the original Boston Tea Party, was about, you know, taxation, representation, and smaller government. These guys just seem like they're nuts. Like, they're okay with getting rid of democracy. They're okay with dictatorship. Isn't that like the biggest evolution of that extremism?
I think so. And it's, I think that, you know, they're the party of the grievances. So they really feel like, you know, liberal Democrats frown on them. And they just hate that. And they really, really see Democrats as the enemy. Mm-hmm. And they see, and like, not in a way that it's like you just disagree with the politics. Like, you have to hate them. You have to demonize them. They consider them evil Marxists. And they've done a masterful job of, like, reframing the language so that, like, if you listen closely, like, at a Trump rally, They frame Biden as a dictator.
Yes.
Like, they don't think they're supporting a dictatorship. They think they're saving the country from a dictatorship of the deep state and Biden and all of that. And it is really backwards. And I think that they even use some of the language of, like, civil liberties and stuff to defend what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to save the country. And they love to wave around the Constitution and whatnot, but it, you know, and that was what the Tea Parties loved, the pocket Constitution. They always quoting the Constitution, but a lot of those Tea Partiers were on the Capitol steps on January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least one or two of the speakers who were scheduled that day had been original Tea Party people, like Amy Kramer, who organized the rally at the Ellipse that led to the insurrection. She literally founded a Tea Party group that is still around today.
So this sort of dovetails into my last question, which is about the election, and in particular, Bobby Kennedy Jr., who is seemingly a favorite these days among the MAGA crowd. And you said Republicans consider Joe Biden the dictator. Well, Bobby recently said Joe Biden is a greater threat to democracy than Trump. Where do you see his candidacy in terms of its relative threat to democracy, because he could quite conceivably pull votes away from Joe Biden and not Trump? Or do you, like a lot of people and myself, think he's just going to be pulling from Trump?
I think it's really hard to say. I think, you know, Democrats, I think, at least those of us who were around back then, remember this conversation with Ralph Nader when he ran in 2020 or in 2000 and said there's no difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush. And look how that worked out for Democrats, at least anyway, and, you know, Iraq and other parts of the world. And so I think that Democrats are smarter than that. Like, they know that if I kind of think Democrats might complain a lot, but in the end, they know the difference between a fringe candidate and throwing your vote away and helping Trump get elected. And I think they'll probably still come out for Biden. But I don't know. And, it, you know, it's an interesting question about democracy because, Kennedy has every right to run. Like, shouldn't we have more candidates? Yeah, I think maybe we should. Our two-party system is really limiting in some ways. So I wouldn't ever want to say he shouldn't, like, that his candidacy is a threat to democracy. But people voting for him may result in something bad for democracy. And I think that you have to kind of address it that way because I really, you know, we don't want to say he can't run. Like, you shouldn't vote for him. Like, people can vote for him.
Yeah, no, in theory, you're 100% right. I guess the conventional wisdom these days is that we're dealing with extremely challenging times. And if we truly are at a juncture where there is this existential threat to democracy, where there could be no turning back, you'd think someone like Bobby, whose family is so steeped historically in Democratic politics, might consider that. And so I think the stakes are so much different. But I agree with you, and I've said that before as well, that I think most Democrats are smart and they're going to do the right thing. But we don't know. I will make a prediction that in 18 months, Larry Trump will be on Dancing with the Stars. That's where I'm going. So
maybe she can dance with Sean Spicer. They could have can come back.
The comeback kid. Thank you so much for coming on. This was great. And I look forward to chatting with you again sometime.
Thanks for having me on. This was fun.
All righty. Take care. This episode of The Back Room was edited and produced by me, Andy Ostroy. It was co-edited and co-produced by Maddie Rosenberg and co-produced by Jen Hammoud. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Hollander, and our logo was designed by Cricket Langell. And special thanks to Patricia Wind. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast and also follow or subscribe. Until next time, keep your eyes on Washington, Hollywood, and your own backyards, and have a great week.